had not expected it. He looked at her, not quite believing that he had understood it correctly. "It's Dagny Taggart who's your mistress, isn't she?" He did not answer. "I happen to know that you had no compartment on that train, so I know where you've slept for the last 4 nights. Do you want to admit it, or do you want me to send detectives to question her train crews and her house servants?" "Is it Dagny Taggart?"
"Yes," he answered calmly. Her mouth twisted into an ugly chuckle. She was staring past him.
"I should have known it. I should have guessed. That's why it didn't work."
He asked in blank bewilderment, "What didn't work?" She stepped back as if to remind herself of his presence.
"Had you, when she was in our house at the party, had you then?"
"No, since."
"The great businesswoman," she said, "above reproach and feminine weaknesses, the great mind detached from any concern with the body."
She chuckled.
"The bracelet," she said, with the still look that made it sound as if the words were dropped accidentally out of the torrent in her mind. "That's what she meant to you. That's the weapon she gave you."
"If you really understand what you're saying, yes."
"Do you think I'll let you get away with it?"
"Get away?"
He was looking at her incredulously in cold, astonished curiosity. "That's why, at your trial."
She stopped. "What about my trial?" She was trembling.
"You know, of course, that I won't allow this to continue."
"What does it have to do with my trial?"
"I won't permit you to have her. Not her. Anyone but her."
He let a moment pass, then asked evenly, "Why?"
"I won't permit it. You'll give it up."
He was looking at her without expression, but the steadiness of his eyes hit her as his most dangerous answer.
"You'll give it up. You'll leave her. You'll never see her again."
"Lillian, if you wish to discuss it, there's one thing you'd better understand. Nothing on earth will make me give it up."
"But I demand it."
"I told you that you could demand anything but that."
He saw the look of a peculiar panic growing in her eyes. It was not the look of understanding, but of a ferocious refusal to understand, as if she wanted to turn the violence of her emotion into a fog screen, as if she hoped not that it would blind her to reality, but that her blindness would make reality cease to exist.
"But I have the right to demand it. I own your life. It's my property by your own oath. You swore to serve my happiness.
Not yours, mine. What have you done for me? You've given me nothing. You've sacrificed nothing. You've never been concerned with anything but yourself, your work, your mills, your talent, your mistress. What about me? I hold first claim. I'm presenting it for collection. You're the account I own."
It was the look on his face that drove her up the rising steps of her voice, scream by scream, into terror. She was seeing not anger or pain or guilt, but the one inviolate enemy, indifference.
"Have you thought of me?" she screamed, her voice breaking against his face. "Have you thought of what you're doing to me? You have no right to go on if you know that you're putting me through hell every time you sleep with that woman. I can't stand it. I can't stand one moment of knowing it. Will you sacrifice me to your animal desire? Are you as vicious and selfish as that? Can you buy your pleasure at the price of my suffering? Can you have it if this is what it does to me?"
Feeling nothing but the emptiness of wonder, he observed the thing which he had glimpsed briefly in the past and was now seeing in the full ugliness of its futility, the spectacle of pleas for pity, delivered in snarling hatred, as threats and as demands. "Lillian," he said very quietly, "I would have it, even if it took your life." She heard it. She heard more than he was ready to know and to hear in his own words. The shock to him was that she did not scream in answer, but that he saw her instead shrinking down into calm.
"You have no right," she said dully.
It had the embarrassing helplessness of the words of a person who knows her own words to be meaningless. "Whatever claim you may have on me," he said, "no human being can hold on another a claim demanding that he wipe himself out of existence."
"Does she mean as much as that to you?"
"Much more than that." The look of thought was returning to her face, but in her face it had the quality of a look of cunning, She remained silent.
Lillian, I'm glad that you know the truth. Now you can make a choice with full understanding. You may divorce me, or you may ask that we continue as we are. That is the only choice you have. It is all I can offer you. I think you know I want you to divorce me, but I don't ask for sacrifices. I don't know what sort of comfort you can find in our marriage, but if you do, I won't ask you to give it up. I don't know why you should want to hold me now. I don't know what it is that I mean to you. I don't know what you're seeking, what form of happiness is yours, or what you will obtain from a situation which I see as intolerable for both of us. By every standard of mine, you should have divorced me long ago. By every standard of mine, to maintain our marriage will be a vicious fraud. But my standards are not yours. I do not understand yours, I never have, but I will accept them. If this is the manner of your love for me, if bearing the name of my wife will give you some form of contentment, I won't take it away from you. It's I who've broken my word, so I will atone for it to the extent I can. You know, of course, that I could buy one of those modern judges and obtain a divorce any time I wished. I won't do it. I will keep my word if you so desire. But this is the only form in which I can keep it. Now make your choice. But if you choose to hold me, you must never speak to me about her. You must never show her that you know if you meet her in the future. You must never touch that part of my life. She stood still, looking up at him. The posture of her body slouched and loose, as if its sloppiness were a form of defiance, as if she did not care to resume, for his sake, the discipline of a graceful bearing. "Miss Dagny Taggart," she said, and chuckled, the superwoman, whom common average wives were not supposed to suspect, the woman who cared for nothing but business and dealt with men as a man, the woman of great spirit who admired you platonically just for your genius, your mills, and your metal. She chuckled. "I should have known that she was just a bitch who wanted you in the same way as any bitch would want you, because you are fully as expert in bed as you are at a desk, if I'm a judge of such matters. But she would appreciate that better than I, since she worships expertness of any kind, and since she has probably been laid by every section hand on a railroad." She stopped, because she saw for the first time in her life by what sort of look one learns that a man is capable of killing. But he was not looking at her. She was not sure whether he was seeing her at all or hearing her voice. He was hearing his own voice, saying her words, saying them to Dagny in the sun-striped bedroom of Ellis Wyatt's house. He was seeing in the nights behind him Dagny's face in those moments when, his body leaving hers, she lay still with a look of radiance that was more than a smile, a look of youth, of early morning, of gratitude to the fact of one's own existence. And he was seeing Lillian's face, as he had seen it in bed beside him, a lifeless face with evasive eyes, with some feeble sneer on its lips and the look of sharing some smutty guilt. He saw who was the accuser and who the accused. He saw the obscenity of letting impotence hold itself as virtue and damn the power of living as a sin. He saw with the clarity of direct perception, in the shock of a single instant, the terrible ugliness of that which had once been his own belief. It was only an instant, a conviction without words, a knowledge grasped as a feeling left unsealed by his mind. The shock brought him back to the sight of Lillian and to the sound of her words. She appeared to him suddenly as some inconsequential presence that had to be dealt with at the moment. "Lillian," he said, in an unstressed voice that did not grant her even the honor of anger, "you are not to speak of her to me. If you ever do it again, I will answer you as I would answer a hoodlum. I will beat you up. Neither you nor anyone else is to discuss her." She glanced at him.
"Really?" she said. It had an odd, casual sound, as if the word were tossed away, leaving some hook implanted in her mind. She seemed to be considering some sudden vision of her own. He said quietly, in weary astonishment,
"I thought you would be glad to discover the truth. I thought you would prefer to know, for the sake of whatever love or respect you felt for me, that if I betrayed you, it was not cheaply and casually, it was not for a chorus girl, but for the cleanest and most serious feeling of my life." The ferocious spring with which she whirled to him was involuntary, as was the naked twist of hatred in her face.
"Oh, you goddamn fool!"
He remained silent.
Her composure returned with the faint suggestion of a smile of secret mockery. "I believe you're waiting for my answer," she said. "No, I won't divorce you. Don't ever hope for that. We shall continue as we are, if that is what you offered, and if you think it can continue.
See whether you can flout all moral principles and get away with it."
He did not listen to her while she reached for her coat, telling him that she was going back to their home. He barely noticed it when the door closed after her. He stood motionless, held by a feeling he had never experienced before. He knew that he would have to think later, to think and understand. But for the moment he wanted nothing but to observe the wonder of what he felt. It was a sense of freedom, as if he stood alone in the midst of an endless sweep of clean air with only the memory of some weight that had been torn off his shoulders. It was the feeling of an immense deliverance. It was the knowledge that it did not matter to him what Lillian felt, what she suffered, or what became of her. And more, not only that it did not matter, but the shining, guiltless knowledge that it did not have to matter.
They waited until the door closed after him, then resumed their seats. They did not look at one another. They had not heard the text of Directive Number 10-289, but they knew what it would contain. They had known it for a long time, in that special manner which consisted of keeping secrets from oneself and leaving knowledge untranslated into words. And by the same method, they now wished it were possible for them not to hear the words of the directive. It was to avoid moments such as this that all the complex twistings of their minds had been devised. They wished the directive to go into effect. They wished it could be put into effect without words, so that they would not have to know that what they were doing was what it was. Nobody had ever announced that Directive Number 10-289 was the final goal of his efforts. Yet for generations past, men had worked to make it possible, and for months past, every provision of it had been prepared for by countless speeches, articles, sermons, editorials, by purposeful voices that screamed with anger if anyone named their purpose. "The picture now is this," said Wesley Mooch. "The economic condition of the country was better the year before last than it was last year, and last year it was better than it is at present. It's obvious that we would not be able to survive another year of the same progression. Therefore, our sole objective must now be to hold the line, to stand still in order to catch our stride, to achieve total stability. Freedom has been given a chance and has failed. Therefore, more stringent controls are necessary. Since men are unable and unwilling to solve their problems voluntarily, they must be forced to do it." He paused, picked up the sheet of paper, then added in a less formal tone of voice, "Hell, what it comes down to is that we can manage to exist as and where we are, but we can't afford to move, so we've got to stand still. We've got to stand still. We've got to make those bastards stand still." His head drawn into his shoulders, he was looking at them with the anger of a man declaring that the country's troubles were a personal affront to him. So many men seeking favors had been afraid of him that he now acted as if his anger were a solution to everything, as if his anger were omnipotent, as if all he had to do was to get angry. Yet, facing him, the men who sat in a silent semicircle before his desk were uncertain whether the presence of fear in the room was their own emotion, or whether the hunched figure behind the desk generated the panic of a cornered rat. Wesley Mooch had a long, square face and a flat-topped skull, made more so by a brush haircut. His lower lip was a petulant bulb, and the pale brownish pupils of his eyes looked like the yolks of eggs, smeared under the not fully translucent whites. His facial muscles moved abruptly, and the movement vanished, having conveyed no expression. No one had ever seen him smile. Wesley Mooch came from a family that had known neither poverty nor wealth nor distinction for many generations. It had clung, however, to a tradition of its own, that of being college-bred, and therefore of despising men who were in business. The family's diplomas had always hung on the wall in the manner of a reproach to the world, because the diplomas had not automatically produced the material equivalents of their attested spiritual value. Among the family's numerous relatives, there was one rich uncle. He had married his money, and in his widowed old age he had picked Wesley as his favorite from among his many nephews and nieces, because Wesley was the least distinguished of the lot, and therefore, thought Uncle Julius, the safest. Uncle Julius did not care for people who were brilliant. He did not care for the trouble of managing his money either, so he turned the job over to Wesley. By the time Wesley graduated from college, there was no money to manage. Uncle Julius blamed it on Wesley's cunning, and cried that Wesley was an unscrupulous schemer. But there had been no scheme about it. Wesley could not have said just where the money had gone. In high school, Wesley Mooch had been one of the worst students and had passionately envied those who were the best. College taught him that he did not have to envy them at all. After graduation, he took a job in the advertising department of a company that manufactured a bogus corn cure. The cure sold well, and he rose to be the head of his department. He left it to take charge of the advertising of a hair restorer, then of a patented brassiere, then of a new soap, then of a soft drink. And then he became advertising vice president of an automobile concern. He tried to sell automobiles as if they were a bogus corn cure. They did not sell. He blamed it on the insufficiency of his advertising budget. It was the president of the automobile concern who recommended him to Reardon. It was Reardon who introduced him to Washington. Reardon, who knew no standard by which to judge the activities of his Washington man. It was James Taggart who had given him a start in the Bureau of Economic Planning and National Resources, in exchange for double-crossing Reardon, in order to help Orrin Boyle, in exchange for destroying Dan Conway. From then on, people helped Wesley Mooch to advance, for the same reason as that which had prompted Uncle Julius. They were people who believed that mediocrity was safe. The men who now sat in front of his desk had been taught that the law of causality was a superstition, and that one had to deal with the situation of the moment without considering its cause. By situation of the moment, they had concluded that Wesley Mooch was a man of superlative skill and cunning, since millions aspired to power, but he was the one who had achieved it. It was not within their method of thinking to know that Wesley Mooch was the zero at the meeting point of forces unleashed in destruction against one another. "This is just a rough draft of Directive Number 10-289, said Wesley Mooch, "which Jean, Clem, and I have dashed off just to give you the general idea. We want to hear your opinions, suggestions, and so forth, you being the representatives of labor, industry, transportation, and the professions." Fred Kinnan got off the windowsill and sat down on the arm of a chair. Orrin Boyle spit out the butt of his cigar. James Taggart looked down at his own hands. Dr. Ferris was the only one who seemed to be at ease. "In the name of the general welfare," read Wesley Mooch, "to protect the people's security, to achieve full equality and total stability, it is decreed for the duration of the national emergency that, point one, all workers, wage earners, and employees of any kind whatsoever shall henceforth be attached to their jobs and shall not leave, nor be dismissed, nor change employment, under penalty of a term in jail. The penalty shall be determined by the Unification Board, such board to be appointed by the Bureau of Economic Planning and National Resources. All persons reaching the age of 21 shall report to the Unification Board, which shall assign them to where, in its opinion, their services will best serve the interests of the nation. Point two, all industrial, commercial, manufacturing, and business establishments of any nature whatsoever shall henceforth remain in operation, and the owners of such establishments shall not quit, nor leave, nor retire, nor close, sell, or transfer their business, under penalty of the nationalization of their establishment and of any and all of their property. Point three, all patents and copyrights pertaining to any devices, inventions, formulas, processes, and works of any nature whatsoever shall be turned over to the nation as a patriotic emergency gift by means of gift certificates to be signed voluntarily by the owners of all such patents and copyrights. The Unification Board shall then license the use of such patents and copyrights to all applicants equally and without discrimination for the purpose of eliminating monopolistic practices, discarding obsolete products, and making the best available to the whole nation. No trademarks, brand names, or copyrighted titles shall be used. Every formerly patented product shall be known by a new name and sold by all manufacturers under the same name, such name to be selected by the Unification Board. All private trademarks and brand names are hereby abolished. Point four, no new devices, inventions, products, or goods of any nature whatsoever not now on the market shall be produced, invented, manufactured, or sold after the date of this directive. The Office of Patents and Copyrights is hereby suspended. Point five, every establishment, concern, corporation, or person engaged in production of any nature whatsoever shall henceforth produce the same amount of goods per year as it, they, or he produced during the basic year, no more and no less. The year to be known as the basic or yardstick year is to be the year ending on the date of this directive. Over or under production shall be fined, such fines to be determined by the Unification Board. Point six, every person of any age, sex, class, or income shall henceforth spend the same amount of money on the purchase of goods per year as he or she spent during the basic year, no more and no less. Over or under purchasing shall be fined, such fines to be determined by the Unification Board. Point seven, All wages, prices, salaries, dividends, profits, interest rates, and forms of income of any nature whatsoever shall be frozen at their present figures as of the date of this directive. Point 8. All cases arising from and rules not specifically provided for in this directive shall be settled and determined by the Unification Board, whose decisions will be final. There was, even within the four men who had listened, a remnant of human dignity, which made them sit still and feel sick for the length of 1 minute. James Taggart spoke first. His voice was low, but it had the trembling intensity of an involuntary scream.
"Well, why not? Why should they have it if we don't? Why should they stand above us? If we are to perish, let's make sure that we all perish together. Let's make sure that we leave them no chance to survive.
That's a damn funny thing to say about a very practical plan that will benefit everybody," said Orrin Boyle shrilly, looking at Taggart in frightened astonishment.
Dr. Ferris chuckled. Taggart's eyes seemed to focus, and he said, his voice louder,
"Yes, of course, it's a very practical plan. It's necessary, practical and just. It will solve everybody's problems. It will give everybody a chance to feel safe, a chance to rest.
It will give security to the people," said Eugene Lawson, his mouth slithering into a smile.
"Security, that's what the people want. If they want it, why shouldn't they have it? Just because a handful of rich will object?"
"It's not the rich who'll object," said Dr. Ferris lazily.
"The rich drool for security more than any other sort of animal. Haven't you discovered that yet?"
"Well, who'll object?" snapped Lawson.
Dr. Ferris smiled pointedly and did not answer. Lawson looked away.
"To hell with them. Why should we worry about them? We've got to run the world for the sake of the little people. It's intelligence that's caused all the troubles of humanity. Man's mind is the root of all evil. This is the day of the heart. It's the weak, the meek, the sick, and the humble that must be the only objects of our concern."
His lower lip was twisting in soft, lecherous motions. "Those who are big are here to serve those who aren't. If they refuse to do their moral duty, we've got to force them. There once was an age of reason, but we've progressed beyond it. This is the age of love."
"Shut up!" screamed James Taggart.
They all stared at him.
"For Christ's sake, Jim, what's the matter?" said Orrin Boyle, shaking.
"Nothing," said Taggart. "Nothing. Wesley, keep him still, will you?"
Mooch said uncomfortably,
"But I fail to see."
"Just keep him still. We don't have to listen to him, do we?"
"Why, no, but—"
"Then let's go on."
"What is this?" demanded Lawson. "I resent it. I most emphatically—" But he saw no support in the faces around him, and stopped, his mouth sagging into an expression of pouting hatred.
"Let's go on," said Taggart feverishly.
"What's the matter with you?" asked Orrin Boyle, trying not to know what was the matter with himself and why he felt frightened.
"Genius is a superstition, Jim," said Dr. Ferris slowly, with an odd kind of emphasis, as if knowing that he was naming the unnamed in all their minds.
"There's no such thing as the intellect. A man's brain is a social product, a sum of influences that he's picked up from those around him. Nobody invents anything. He merely reflects what's floating in the social atmosphere. A genius is an intellectual scavenger and a greedy hoarder of the ideas which rightfully belong to society from which he stole them. All thought is theft. If we do away with private fortunes, we'll have a fair distribution of wealth. If we do away with genius, we'll have a fairer distribution of ideas."
"Are we here to talk business, or are we here to kid one another?" asked Fred Kinnan.
They turned to him. He was a muscular man with large features, but his face had the astonishing property of finely drawn lines that raised the corners of his mouth into the permanent hint of a wise, sardonic grin. He sat on the arm of the chair, hands in pockets, looking at Mooch with the smiling glance of a hardened policeman at a shoplifter.
"All I've got to say is that you'd better staff that Unification Board with my men," he said. "Better make sure of it, brother, or I'll blast your point one to hell."
"I intend, of course, to have a representative of labor on that board," said Mooch dryly, "as well as a representative of industry, of the professions, and of every cross-section of—"
"No cross-sections," said Fred Kinnan evenly. "Just representatives of labor. Period." "What the hell?" yelled Orrin Boyle. "That's stacking the cards, isn't it?"
"Sure,"
said Fred Kinnan.
"But that will give you a stranglehold on every business in the country."
"What do you think I'm after?"
"That's unfair," yelled Boyle. "I won't stand for it.
You have no right. You...
Right? Said Kennan innocently. Are we talking about rights?
But, I mean, after all, there are certain fundamental property rights which...
Listen, pal, you want point three, don't you?
Well, I...
Then you'd better keep your trap shut about property rights from now on. Keep it shut tight.
Mr. Kennan, said Dr. Ferris, you must not make the old-fashioned mistake of drawing wide generalizations. Our policy has to be flexible. There are no absolute principles which...
Save it for Jim Taggart, Doc, said Fred Kennan. I know what I'm talking about. That's because I never went to college.
I object, said Boyle, to your dictatorial method of...
Kennan turned his back on him and said,
Listen, Wesley, my boys won't like point one. If I get to run things, I'll make them swallow it. If not, not. Just make up your mind.
Well, said Mooch and stopped.
For Christ's sake, Wesley, what about us? Yelled Taggart.
You'll come to me, said Kennan, when you'll need a deal to fix the board. But I'll run that board. Me and Wesley.
Do you think the country will stand for it? Yelled Taggart.
Stop kidding yourself, said Kennan. The country? If there aren't any principles anymore, and I guess the doc is right because there sure aren't, if there aren't any rules to this game and it's only a question of who robs whom, then I've got more votes than the bunch of you. There are more workers than employers, and don't you forget it, boys.
That's a funny attitude to take, said Taggart haughtily. About a measure which, after all, is not designed for the selfish benefit of workers or employers, but for the general welfare of the public.
Okay, said Kennan amiably. Let's talk your lingo. Who is the public? If you go by quality, then it ain't you, Jim, and it ain't Ori Boyle. If you go by quantity, then it sure is me, because quantity is what I've got behind me.
His smile disappeared, and with a sudden bitter look of weariness, he added,
Only I'm not going to say that I'm working for the welfare of my public, because I know I'm not. I know that I'm delivering the poor bastards into slavery, and that's all there is to it, and they know it too. But they know that I'll have to throw them a crumb once in a while if I want to keep my racket. Well, with the rest of you, they wouldn't have a chance in hell. So that's why, if they've got to be under a whip, they'd rather I held it, not you. You drooling, tear-jerking, mealy-mouthed bastards of the public welfare? Do you think that outside of your college-bred pansies, there's one village idiot whom you're fooling? I'm a racketeer, but I know it, and my boys know it, and they know that I'll pay off. Not out of the kindness of my heart, either, and not a cent more than I can get away with. But at least they can count on that much. Sure, it makes me sick sometimes. It makes me sick right now. But it's not me who's built this kind of world. You did. So I'm playing the game as you've set it up, and I'm going to play it for as long as it lasts, which isn't going to be long for any of us.
He stood up. No one answered him. He let his eyes move slowly from face to face and stop on Wesley Mooch.
Do I get the board, Wesley? He asked casually.
The selection of these specific personnel is only a technical detail, said Mooch pleasantly. Suppose we discuss it later, you and I. Everybody in the room knew that this meant the answer, yes.
Okay, pal, said Kennan.
He went back to the window, sat down on the sill, and lighted a cigarette. For some unadmitted reason, the others were looking at Dr. Ferris as if seeking guidance.
Don't be disturbed by oratory, said Dr. Ferris smoothly. Mr. Kennan is a fine speaker, but he has no sense of practical reality. He is unable to think dialectically.
There was another silence. Then James Taggart spoke up suddenly.
I don't care. It doesn't matter. He'll have to hold things still. Everything will have to remain as it is, just as it is. Nobody will be permitted to change anything.
Except, he turned sharply to Wesley Mooch. Wesley, under point four, we'll have to close all research departments, experimental laboratories, scientific foundations, and all the rest of the institutions of that kind. They'll have to be forbidden.
Yes, that's right, said Mooch. I hadn't thought of that. We'll have to stick in a couple of lines about that.
He hunted around for a pencil and made a few scrawls on the margin of his paper.
It will end wasteful competition, said James Taggart. We'll stop scrambling to beat one another to the untried and the unknown. We won't have to worry about new inventions upsetting the market. We won't have to pour money down the drain in useless experiments just to keep up with overambitious competitors.
Yes, said Orrin Boyle. Nobody should be allowed to waste money on the new until everybody has plenty of the old. Close all those damn research laboratories, and the sooner the better.
Yes, said Wesley Mooch. We'll close them, All of them,